We have a few callers who will be calling in. I don't have any in-person guests, but we'll be talking about some things I've come across in the last few days, maybe a little discussion on ethics around robotics, and we'll see where it goes from there.
You know, I was chatting with Molly, will be up in like 1 second. I got confronted by the robot in Stop and Shop about a week or so ago.
Really?
It was kind of a freaky situation.
Yeah. Because
it would move, I would move, then it would move, then it would stop. Then I say, wait a minute, they're already making me, you know, make, you know, cash out my own groceries and stuff. Yeah. What is next? Somebody's going to replace me shopping for my food?
So probably.
Chatting with Molly is up right now, and take it away.
Great.
A Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor. Grow up to be a hero and a scholar.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Then a hurricane came and devastation rained. Our man saw his future drip, dripping down the drain. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain.
Well, the word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you wait.
When he was 10, his father split, full of it, debt-ridden. 2 years later, see Alex and his mother bedridden, half dead, sitting in their own sick, the scent thick.
And Alex got better, but his mother went quick.
Moved in with a cousin, the cousin committed suicide, left him with nothing but ruined pride. Something new inside, a voice saying,
Alex, you gotta fend for yourself.
He started retreating and reading every treatise on the shelf.
There would have been nothing left to do for someone less astute. He would have been dead or destitute without a cent or restitution. Started working, clerking for his late mother's landlord, trading sugar cane and rum
ran from America, forgot him.
We fought with him.
Me, I died for him.
Me,
I trusted him.
Me, I loved him.
And me, I'm the damn fool that shot him.
There's a million things I haven't done, but just you.
All righty, it is currently 12:06 p.m. This is DJ Molly on Chatting with Molly, and you are listening to 91.5 WMFO, Tufts Freeform Radio. Happy Wednesday, everyone. Want to give a quick shout out to DJ D and Mike Stewart for conducting an awesome interview with Christine Ullman the last hour. She is a musician who has a show this upcoming week, and she was the lead singer on the SNL band and has some great music. So you guys should all try to make it out to her show on at 9 Wallace, I believe, on Saturday the 26th. All right, what else do we have going on today? I want to talk about the WMFO Live Day here at WMFO on Saturday, May 4th. Tune in to hear some of your favorite local musicians between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. We're going to host 9 bands and musicians. Yes, folks, that is 9. So tune in. It's going to be pretty cool. I'll just run through the list. The Cast Irons, Anthony Kaczynski, Peter Parchek, Daniel Maraglia with Lisa Bastoni, Lily Black, 62 Ghosts, Will Daly, Flight of Fire, and Celebutant. And so that's so cool that WMFO has such an awesome studio to allow for such cool live music. So back to the regular scheduled programming. I'm here in the studio with no guest today, actually. So it's going to be a lot of me talking and posing questions out to the wind of all you listeners. So please call in to answer and or text me your answers, and we can just have a live convo that way. So there's a lot of things I want to talk about today. First, I'm just coming from my robotics class, as I do each week. So I'll just kind of talk about that. We have a 2-week project going on right now. So this is the only Wednesday that we weren't presenting something because it's due next week. It's our final project. And the name of the project is Puppet Week. And so we will present next Wednesday, and the provost of the school will be coming. And she's she used to be head of the vet school, I believe. And so our puppets are all like animals, and she's going to judge them based on cuteness. So they have to actually interact with her, which is a pretty difficult task, but we'll figure it out, I guess. And so in class today, actually my professor did something we've never done before. Because we weren't presenting, we just kind of had a bunch of time. And so he had us talk about ethical dilemmas in robotics. And I think it was really interesting to kind of dive into what people thought. My group was discussing privacy rights and right to data. And we were talking about it in the context of Alexa and Google. So Google Photos is a service I use, and they have free storage for your photos, and then they use your photos to train their machine learning facial recognition software. So they will allow you to say that you don't want your data used for that anymore, but it's very unclear how to do that. And actually, once you upload them, it goes straight to the machine learning algorithm. And then later, you can take it out of the archives. But once you train an ever-learning machine on something like photos, it can't unlearn. You're not undoing, you don't have a perfect layout of each development of this machine learning algorithm. And so that kind of gets hairy on their advertising or their expressing this availability to pull your data, but if there's a little bit of deceit going on, because there's really not that choice actually offered. And so that's kind of interesting. And my professor was really pushing back on the idea that why would anyone not want their data? You know, he gave the example of, you know, when you're talking to me right now, I'm taking in your face, I'm taking in your voice, and I'm, you know, collecting data on you. And why are you not okay with this, this algorithm doing it, which could honestly try to, you know, help you in more ways than I could help you? And I think it's really the best parallel that I can think of is when you're in government class in high school and you're learning about all the protections the Constitution has set up for rights of the accused and making sure that there's a very logical protocol of how people are collecting data in a sense of how to make a case against someone. There's really strict guidelines of police can't just break into your house and find your DNA on your hairbrush. You have to get a warrant for that. And you know, the argument always comes up. I remember I thought this too. If you have nothing to hide, why do you care if the government is taking your DNA off your hairbrush? That should only bother you if you did something wrong. Well, we know that things go wrong all the time. And we know that the government has certain prejudices and the people acting on behalf of the government have certain prejudices. And a totalitarian government that just kind of locks people up from, you know, like grabbing everyone's DNA all the time is not what we want and not what the like revolutionaries were fighting for. And they were coming off of this big totalitarian government of England. And I think it's really similar to the kind of corporate need for all of our data in the same way is that, yeah, they're making products that help us, but they're also profit. Like their main goal of being a company is profit, right? And that is not always going to be in the consumer's best interest. And I think that maybe I'm a cynic, but I certainly do not have the confidence in every like head of technology or head of engineering in every company that they're making these moral decisions. And I think we do need to have these safeguards against them overreaching. And like if Alexa is collecting every word that is going on in a household and the FBI wants to get their hands on certain conversations held, that's just like more vulnerable placement of data that we're like allowing to be recorded. And I think like something to be reminded is the people who are getting hurt the most are the people who are marginalized in other ways and the vulnerable people who we know for a fact after 9/11, people, Muslims and people with Arab descent got targeted more so than before because there was this Islamophobia from the terrorist attacks. And I think that in cases in which the government or even companies will wrongly act or wrongly like collect data, I think the people that are getting hurt are the ones who are in marginalized positions to begin with. So we can say like, oh, I, you know, as like a white woman with a name like Molly Lipman that no one's gonna like flag me at TSA for, I'm fine with Alexa collecting all my data. But what if I was growing up in an Arabic speaking household? Like, would I be okay with using data that like someone could use my fine actions against me just like for doing something that's already marginalized? So I don't know. I think it's something to keep in mind, and this needs to be said for, I guess, every conversation, but realizing, like, who's making the decisions and who's getting affected negatively, and are the marginalized populations present during those conversations? We also talked a lot about the kind of protocols in which we train these algorithms. The U.S. safety training for all cars is based off of a safety dummy that is to reflect the average male, which is like 5'9", 180 pounds, and whatever else, height, whatever. And they, no cars are tested on females or pregnant females or children. And there are very real things like how an airbag affects a woman versus a man that are like super big concerns that we just like, we aren't testing for. And again, it's, I think it's really important to make sure everyone's representing those conversations. And also, just like as safety dummies, we should have two types of dummies to reflect like different body types, to make sure cars can protect everyone. A story came out last week that the Apple iPhone is like the new 10 has amazing facial detection and can tell twins apart, but they can tell white twins apart. There was a Chinese twin set that could get their phones to unlock each other's phones because Apple machine learning couldn't tell two Chinese twins apart, even though they could the Americans. And so I think that, yeah, just like shows that we need a bigger diversity in like these STEM conversations. And so, yeah, I thought that was really interesting that we talked about kind of ethics of robotics. I mean, it was only like a 25-minute conversation over the course of an entire semester is not that much allocation, but it was nice to hear people's opinions. And I think we, as engineers, are the people who are pushing to like make a cool robot that can, you know, process huge amounts of data and images, but that comes at a cost. And I think engineers need to be the first to recognize that and be proactive about how much data they really are collecting. And yeah, so that's kind of interesting. The next thing I wanted to talk about, again, listeners, if you want to call in, please feel free to do so. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was camp, I guess. So last night, so every supervisor at my camp was mandated sounds pretty harsh, but we all needed to do a Torah study with our one of the directors and two people on like the Jewish education team. So I had mine last night. Unfortunately, my co was working. Shout out to Matthew if he's listening. This can be a little debrief for you. And we got on a Zoom call, read some Torah, and then talked about how we want to incorporate this to campers, which means how do we incorporate this to our staff? And then what Jewish values are going to come from this Torah portion? And I would also really like to talk about values today, because there's this amazing website called jewishcamp.org. It's run by the Foundation for Jewish Camp, but they have an amazing like graphic that's called a periodic table of Jewish midot, which means values. And so there are six categories. And there's courage, honor, justice, moderation, transcendence, and wisdom. And within those five categories, there's like seven or eight underlying like values in each one. So I thought that was really interesting that this organization has kind of like outlined exactly what it, and it's called making mensches, which is like a really good person. And so what do we need to in ourselves to be a mensch? And I think the most in all of them, okay, I'll read some of them. There's like wisdom, courage, understanding, zest and zeal. That's a fun one. Decency and social intelligence, sensibility, curiosity, creativity, appreciation of opposition. Love that one. Foresight, integrity, leadership. And then there's things like piety, modesty, humility, contentment. And then there's like wonder, love, gratitude, joy, all those. So there's a lot of them. But one that's on there, let's see what category it's in. It's in the category of honor. So one is loyalty. And that one just stuck out to me right away because I don't really believe in loyalty. I don't think it's important ever. My biggest argument is like the word blind loyalty. Like, it's not good to just be loyal for the sake of being loyal. Like, no matter what, you follow this person. Okay, I think we can all like agree there's problems in that. Because if the person does something badly, why should loyalty trump like bad behavior? Which, I don't know. I think that's a pretty straightforward argument. But I don't see loyalty in any other capacity. This is definitely a moment I wish I had a guest on here or a caller to argue with me. I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but refute, that's the word. And I don't see how loyalty would ever be important because you ask the question, well, why are you loyal? I think the answer to that is the reason why you follow someone. Oh, I'm loyal to this person because they're a great leader. They have great creativity. They have great, insert any value I just mentioned, courage. Whatever reason you have to be loyal, those can just be the reasons that you have your actions to support them. Oh, we are getting a caller. Okay, this is our standard caller. Let's see if he has any opinions on the matter. Hello, caller.
Hello. This is to refute the loyalty thing. There is something in between blind loyalty and zero loyalty. In between, there's something like loyalty to people you know and love is weight on the scale. It can be outweighed, but it's weight on the scale. It's not blind loyalty, but it's not zero.
But my question is, why do you know and love them? Whatever the answer to that question is, that is the actual weight on the scale. It's not loyalty. Like, if you're loyal to someone and there's nothing backing it up, they don't have to be bad. But if they're just a neutral person that you have no reason to be loyal to and you just are because, I don't know, maybe you're told or you're loyal for some reason, that's what goes on the scale, you know?
Well, that, then you're just saying you shouldn't be loyal. And we can argue about who you should be loyal to and who you shouldn't. But assuming you're loyal to someone you should be loyal to, that's really your problem. And then you say, well, what does it do for weight? Like, say I have a lollipop, and I can either give it to my daughter, who I love and am loyal to, or give it to some stranger. I would give it to my daughter. And, you know, would you disagree? For the listeners, you are my daughter.
Yeah, I hate to be so biased in this decision, but I would say that I don't expect you to give it to me for this, like, concept of loyalty. Whatever, like, you don't need to answer this question, but
well,
whyever you...
spoiling you.
But whyever you love me, whether you think I'm a nice person, you think I'm a good leader, you think I am best fit to have this lollipop, that is why you should give it to me.
Well, those are reasons too, but loyalty is an additional reason. I mean, say I do love you, and I do think you're a good person. I do think you're a good leader, all that stuff. But, you know, imagine that you were a different person and I didn't. You were my daughter, and this is counterfactual. You were a lousy, terrible person, but you were my daughter. That would still give some loyalty to you as to whether to give the lollipop to you or a stranger.
See, that's what I disagree with. If I don't see any trait that loyalty can trump. Like, all those things you said is like totally means give the lollipop to the stranger. Why would you give the lollipop to me? That makes no sense.
Because I'm loyal to you because you're my family member. Not blindly loyal, but, you know, loyal in the sense that it gets some weight on the scale. Does he trump everything else or veto everything else? It can be outweighed, but it's weighed on the scale.
Man, I guess this is just a different in value because I don't see loyalty as a positive weight on the scale at all. It seems very obscure to me. It seems of no backing.
So, like, say you had an adult diaper and the choice was to give it to your father or a stranger who needed it. Are you saying you'd give it to a stranger?
Well, I think there is something to be said about, like, valuing family, but that is backed up.
Okay, that's loyalty.
No, but that's backed up by a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with loyalty. As in, this, like, family often is a support network before anyone else is a support network for you. And in cases where no one else is there for you because of, like, there's just a general understanding of support. And as soon as that support goes away, then it doesn't matter. Like, families are non-supportive of each other all the time. And I think just because they're family doesn't mean that you should be loyal to, like, bad family members.
I respectfully disagree. I think you should be loyal to non-family members. But to your earlier point of, it's not really loyalty, they're a support group, so it's really a quid pro quo. I don't disagree with that. A lot of loyalty is quid pro quo, both for past services and expected future services. I mean, a lot of loyalty and morality has a self-interest component that people don't like to talk about, including loyalty. But that being given, there's still something for loyalty.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, that a lot of morality has self-interest in it. Like, I don't know, like, patience or forgiveness.
Being perceived as being moral.
Right.
Is often in your self-interest.
Right.
That's why the highest virtue is giving to charity anonymously. But not too many people do that. And people who fundraise know damn well that that's not the way to fundraise.
Right. Yeah. Dad, have you ever heard of this periodic table of Midot?
Yes. Vaguely heard of it. Don't know much about it, but I have heard of it. Yet.
Yeah.
Periodic tables for everything. It's sort of like a worn-out metaphor.
Yeah, it's true. But I'll send you this one because I think it's a good list.
Good. I'd be interested in it.
Yeah, I don't know. I just see, like, loyalty in the presence of, like, perseverance and grit and righteousness and decency and social intelligence and love and gratitude. I just think loyalty is, like, so much less important than that.
Well, your last one was gratitude. The ones before that, I agree, are different. And if you want to say the ones before that are greater than loyalty, maybe. But when you said gratitude and loyalty have a lot of overlap.
Yeah. Maybe. I guess I'm a little bit skewed on loyalty lately because I've been watching a lot of Game of Thrones, and which The premiere came out last Sunday, and I caught up. I made it through all seven seasons before the new season, so now I'm up to speed. But
really good for you. I plan to do that, but I haven't quite accomplished it yet.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, loyalty can go askew, as can any virtue, and maybe even loyalty can go askew a little bit more easily, because it is, you know, a way counter to other ways, like, you know, rewarding righteousness and doing the right thing, which probably should come first. But, you know, loyalty does have some, I would still say loyalty has some weight on the scale.
Yeah, I mean, I think a loyalty in the show is often about, like, what house is pledged to what other house, and soldiers, like, swearing an honor. And I, that just seems like so removed from gratitude, you know?
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's real loyalty. That may pretend to be loyalty, but that's really just contract and self-interest.
Yeah.
It purports to be loyalty, I grant you. And Game of Thrones, you know, is famous for, like, people betraying loyalty. I mean, it happens a number of times per episode. So I wouldn't look at that as a lesson in the virtue of loyalty.
That's true.
And loyalty is a tricky thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it goes down to zero.
Yeah, I guess. But I don't know. For me, jury's still out.
Say if you were a family member and you committed a heinous crime, and all your friends deserted you. You know, would a family member, you know, say your father, come visit you in jail, come visit you in prison, help you pay for a lawyer, be a character witness, that kind of thing, which they would not for a stranger. I mean, isn't that loyalty in the good sense?
But if I really committed this heinous crime, would you... yeah. I don't know. I think
I'm not saying I would lie or break you out of jail. I'm just saying, you know, I'd visit you and help you pay for a lawyer. You know, whatever you got, you got.
Right. Okay. So you're doing this for a family member. But I believe that, like, if whatever makes you feel so compelled to help me, whether it's like, you know, why, again, it's why do you feel loyal? If you took the answer to that question and applied it to a non-family member, like you love them just as much, and you know, like, have seen them grow just as much, I think you would do the same thing.
Well, I mean, that's nice, but in the real world, there's limited resources, and you don't know everyone. And if you want to, like, you know, bail out of jail or feed every hungry person on planet Earth, you're going to run out of resources real quickly. So you do have to pick and choose in a world of limited resources. And I think what loyalty is saying is, when you have to pick and choose how you allocate your resources, you know, charity starts at home, and you know, which is another name for loyalty.
Yeah. I think, yeah, that's actually another interesting point. I remember when I was pretty young, and I think mom was talking about, like, oh, donating to the synagogue or something. And I was like, well, why do people only donate to their own organizations? Like, yeah, you said charity starts at home, and yeah, I guess you're, like, giving back to organizations that gave to you. But on the other hand, like, there are really huge amounts of need to organizations that we're not a part of, but maybe have a much greater need than things we are connected to.
All right. Well, I mean, the argument is that loyalty gets weight on the scale, not that it gets infinite weight on the scale, and it can be outweighed. But say, like, the stranger and, you know, and the synagogue had an equal claim, and say, like, you know, the stranger was in the middle of nowhere, a place you've never been, you know, and this the synagogue is, you know, you've been a member, and the claim is equal. And we live in a world of limited resources. You have to pick and choose. You go to, you know, those in, you know, your family, or we all have concentric circles. Yourself, your nuclear family, your extended family, you know, your clan, your neighborhood, your ethnic group, your school, or whatever. We all have concentric circles. You know, you start inside and you move out circle by circle by circle.
Yeah, but I think that maybe goes back to why people donate and like why we have this facade of morality, because maybe it's self-serving. Hello, Dad, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I think that kind of maybe shows that people like to see the impact of what they give, which maybe takes away from the morality of it and maybe doesn't. But I don't know. I think, like you said, you start inside and you keep moving out. But is that because we want to be recognized for it? You know, like we have, you know, my synagogue that is in need, the same amount of need that this like animal shelter is in the middle of Texas that I have no connection to. And if I donate to my synagogue, my name's going to be up there and I'm going to like see the impact. And if I do it somewhere else, I won't get as good of a feeling. But maybe that's like not why we should be donating. We should just be donating like truly based on need.
In a perfect world, maybe. But we don't live in a perfect world. And, you know, as far as getting recognition, I mean, doing charity always have a, you know, a self-promotion, or often has a self-promotion aspect. As far as getting a good feeling of satisfaction by giving to charity, well, you know, humans are humans. You don't want to, you know, lessen the incentive to do a good thing. If one reason amongst many of doing a good thing is makes you feel good, maybe God made it that way to make us do good stuff, because God certainly knows there's plenty of reasons not to. So I wouldn't denigrate, well, you're doing a good thing, but it's only make yourself feel good. You know, that's what happens when you do a good thing. You still deserve all the credit.
Fine. I think, fine. Like, the internal feeling you get, then, like, I'm fine discounting that and saying, like, yeah, it's great. Like, feeling good, like, the more the better. But I do think the self-serving aspect, you discounting it and saying that, like, oh, it's always going to have a piece of that. I don't think that is, like, necessary that we can just accept. I agree that in most cases it is true, but is it inherent and necessary? I don't think so. I think that, like, it is, people say charity starts at home because they like their name on things. And that's a very real thing that, like, I don't know should be guiding our charitable, like, contributions.
That's not the only reason charity starts at home. That certainly is a reason. It may even be the first reason. But a second reason is loyalty. We're going to answer back to loyalty. You'd rather allocate scarce charitable resources, you know, to people in one of your close concentric circles than to a complete stranger. Why? I don't know. It's just human in a world of limited resources.
But doesn't the, like, in the Torah, there's so many things about, like, valuing strangers and guests and, like, treating them. Yeah. And I think maybe that's, like, something we should do more.
Well, yes, that's all true and not inconsistent with loyalty getting some weight on the scale. All that is true. Doesn't mean there's zero to loyalty.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean loyalty isn't the first virtue.
Yeah.
It's also not the last.
Yeah, I think also the biggest, to just totally like go against what I've been arguing this whole time, I think there is a huge amount to be said about knowing the needs of your own community. So when you said, oh, you know, my synagogue and the like puppy shelter in Texas are of equal need, I think that's actually inherently hard to say because everyone really only knows their own community. And this like comes into a lot of problems with people doing like voluntourism in other countries and going into these like poor areas and dumping resources. I have done that in high school. Totally have seen huge problems in those organizations. And I did it twice actually in high school. And I remember coming back the second trip and like feeling pretty uneasy about like, yeah, we just kind of went and like painted this school where like local people could have gotten jobs by painting this school, and is what they need clean water more than just a painted school. And I think I think it's really important to like know your own community and self-advocate for them.
I think you're absolutely right, and the only thing I would add was, you know, for people who work for charities and fundraise for charities, they find out the nitty-gritty of human beings. And it's, you know, it's not always pretty, but if you really believe in the organization and believe you have to do what you have to do, you know, within the law and morality, to raise money, you know, you commonly figure their name, you stress the connection between them and the source and the community, and you play all these cards that are sort of against your, you know, more purist view that, well, you know, we're all brothers and sisters. You give to any organization or person on the face of the earth that has the slightest more need than, you know, your own mother or father. And that's just not the way the real world works.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, on one hand, I think I'm very hesitant to outline a problem and say, well, clap my hands, that's just how it goes. I think there are, like, I do know for a fact there are, like, very, they're very great organizations doing great work in places that need to be done and doing it in a very sustainable way, doing it in a very grassroots way. And I think that seeing these, like, social phenomenons and just saying, well, that's how it goes, is not helpful and actually destructive. And I think
you're right. I mean, that's a good point. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
And yeah, I think there's always ways that we can make it better.
Well put, sweetheart.
Thank you. So, Dad, what do you think, talking about values? You can either answer this in a Jewish way, like what you think the biggest value that's stressed in Judaism, or what you just think as your own person is values you try to instill in yourself and in your family?
Well, my personal virtues and my personal views on virtue and Judaism are very, very, very close. And I think, you know, Judaism is ethical monotheism, and the point of monotheism is that, you know, there's no divides in humanity. We're all brothers and sisters, and now, you know, we all owe a duty. We all have the same mother, father, you know, God, and we all owe a brother, sibling duty to every human being on the face of the earth. And I agree with that. And you may say, well, then why were you arguing for loyalty, which sort of counts against that? I don't know that it does count against it, but I think the first virtue of Judaism is ethical monotheism, and that we're all brothers and sisters.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense, knowing your belief on faith and whatnot. Well, Dad, thanks for calling in. Man, we've really chewed up a lot of this hour.
I guess so, yeah. I'll see you at Midway on Friday.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited to see you. That's so exciting.
Me too. Love you.
All right. Love you. Bye. All right. That was my father calling in from Iowa City, Iowa. And like he just said, I'm going to Chicago this weekend, which I am pumped for. And gonna get a little Passover business going on. And so that's pretty exciting. I'll give a little recap of my weekend. It was Marathon Monday yesterday, or not yesterday, 2 days ago. And we had a 3-day weekend. Best part of a 3-day weekend is the 4-day week that follows or precedes. So that's pretty sweet. If my listeners don't know already, I play for the women's frisbee team here. And so we had our sectionals this weekend, and we are the champions of the Metro Boston section, or conference, I think now it's called. So that's pretty exciting. We beat Northeastern, who's ranked above us, and on Universe, which means like double game point, like it was tied and last point wins. So that was pretty sweet. And then on Sunday, I went and watched the men's frisbee team play at their sectionals. Beautiful day out in Cambridge at the MIT Fields. And it was really awesome getting to see them play because we don't get to do that a lot. And they like fought really hard and had some really tough games. And so I'm excited to see how much they grow and can ball out at regionals. And so that'll be very fun. Okay, for now, I'm going to play a little PSA. And I'll catch you guys back in, 30 seconds, I guess.
Whether I'm going to Johnny Food Masters or cruising the parkway on my TA, I like to tune in to WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. It's wicked pisser.
Okay, that was not exactly what I was expecting. I don't think that quite qualifies as a PSA that I need to do. I think that was more just like a promo, so I guess I'll read. Know your cell phone rights? No, I think I've read that before. Ooh, organ donation. This is a good one. All right. There are many social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. It saves lives. It's matchingdonors.com. Matchingdonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you are someone in need of an organ transplant, visit matchingdonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life. This has been a public service message from matchingdonors.com and WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. Wow, thanks, matchingdonors.com. That's actually really important. Being an organ donor is pretty great. And especially, I mean, kidney donations are like while you're alive, which is like a pretty big life decision, which is amazing and heroic if you decide to do that. But organ donation of like if you die, like stuff on your license that people can use your donors, I think is something everyone should do because it's pretty important. We have about 10 minutes left, and I think I might play a little bit of music because this is actually something I want to talk about. We started off the show with two songs, Freedom by Beyonce, which is one of my all-time favorite songs, and then Alexander Hamilton from Hamilton the Musical, which is just kind of a baller song and very fun, so we had to get that on there. But so Beyonce performed last year at Coachella. Coachella just wrapped up, but the previous year Beyonce was like lead performer, and she made this huge set called Homecoming because she's from LA, and she just came out with a Netflix video or like Netflix movie on the production of this set and performance. And it's supposed to be amazing. And so she also just came out with a Spotify album, which is very unlike her because she owns a different streaming company called Tidal that she streams all of her music on. Most of her music is not on Spotify. So for her to come out with this on Spotify is pretty huge. And it's just like her whole set from that performance. So that's pretty exciting. So I was thinking that I was going to play stuff from that set, but we run into a little problem because most of her things are explicit. So that is really too bad. But doesn't mean we can't play other jams. So one song I've been jamming to lately, actually two songs, are the Jonas Brothers. Now, you say, Molly, that is so 2008 and or 2000 and late. And to that, I would say, great point. But they have come out with two new songs, and they are pretty bopping. So first we're going to play Cool because I think it's better, and then we're going to play Sucker. And the reason this weekend I got really into Sucker is because Joe Jonas is engaged to Sophie Turner, who plays Sansa on Game of Thrones. So I got in this whole wormhole of watching Game of Thrones interviews because I've only been caught up recently, so I've been depriving myself of all wonderful media and fun interviews of all the actors in case they spoil something. And so now I just went on this like huge binge of like watching interviews with all the cast, and Sophie Turner's very cool and engaged to Joe Jonas and is in the music video of Sucker. So with all of that, now we're going to play Cool by the Jonas Brothers.
I'm feeling so cool, top to the bottom, just cool. Every little thing that I do, damn it, I'm feeling so cool, yeah. Woke up feeling like a new James Dean. I comb my hair like an old school scene. I'm feeling high like a late night summer in last year.
That was Cool by the Jonas Brothers. I think that's just such a jam. I hope you guys enjoyed it. So I want to give a quick shout out to Zazu and Nikhil for listening in the dining hall today. I mean, honestly, I don't know if you guys are still listening because it's been a while, but I appreciate the support to my Chatting with Molly fam. I gotta say, today listeners have been a bit down, but love to see the homies. Oh, we're back up at 11. Earlier we were down to 6, so that's kind of a low, but we don't do it for the numbs, we do it for the memes, and always remember that. So okay, to finish out the show, I'm gonna play a little Sucker, which is the song I was talking about before. Oh, I hope you guys also realize the Game of Thrones shout out that Joe Jonas put in Cool, because that's pretty fun. So I'll do my station ID and then we'll just kind of play Sucker and then I'll be out. So it is currently 12:56. This is Molly with Chatting with Molly. You're listening to 91.5 WMFO, Tufts Freeform Radio, and I hope everyone has a happy Wednesday. We go
together, better than birds of a feather, you and me. We change the weather, yeah. I'm feeling heat in December when you found me.
I've been dancing on top of cars and stumbling out of bars. I follow you through the dark, can't get enough. You're the medicine and the pain, the tattoo inside my brain. And baby, you know it's obvious.
I'm a sucker for you. Said a word and I'll go anywhere blindly. I'm a sucker for you. For you,
yeah.
Don't complicate it,
yeah.
'Cause I know you and you know everything about me. I can't remember all of the nights I don't remember when you're around me.
I've been dancing on top of cars and stumbling out of bars. I follow you through the dark, can't get enough. You're the medicine and the pain, the tattoo inside my brain. And maybe you know it's obvious.
I'm a sucker for you.
I'm a sucker for you.